introduce our main speaker for this evening, Charlie from San Diego.
Hi, my name's Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. I finally made the big time, you know. Good sharing tonight. I appreciated the birthdays. Congratulations to everybody. I heard George say something tonight that my sponsor always says. You know, my AA birthday is December 1, 1978. So I've got 32 years, and sometimes I tell people that, and they go, "Oh my God!" And my sponsor's usually with me, and he goes, "You know, as long as you don't die and you don't drink," he said, "you can rack up some years." He said, "The key is emotional sobriety." And I'll share some things with you a little bit later in my timeline about some things that I've done in my sobriety that would indicate that I didn't have any emotional sobriety during that point in time. You know, I'm still a work in progress. Larry's a longtime friend of mine, and he asked me to, we kind of reconnected after a few years, and he asked me if I wanted to be the speaker at the meeting, and I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that." And I said, "How long?" And he said, 45 minutes. I said, 45 minutes? Wow, that's a long time. So I brought some notes here just so that I could remember some things that happened, you know, back in my life. But I had my first drink, our first speaker, and I'm sorry I don't remember your name. I appreciate your sharing, and what you were saying was, you know, hey, it's real simple. What was it like? What happened? And what is it like now? And I'll tell you what happened or what it was like. I was 15 years old, and I was a skinny, awkward, shy kind of kid that really just felt like I didn't fit in, and you hear this same theme over and over again in AA. But I had my first drink when I was 15, and I loved it. And I loved everything alcohol did to me. And I remember explaining it to my brother. My little brother was 14, and I was telling him about what alcohol did to me, and I said, "It's like a magic potion, man. It makes me feel like Superman. I'm handsome and I'm strong, and you know, chicks dig me and guys want to be like me, and you know," I said, "that's just what happens when I drink, you know." So you know, there's a little bit of a drunkalogue that normally takes place in these 45-minute scenarios. So I'll tell you what happened when I was 15. I took my first drink. My brother, Bob, and our buddy across the street, Richard, we'd been hearing some of the older kids talk about drinking, about getting drunk, and we said, "Man, we got to do that." And we didn't really have a sponsor that would bring us into the you know, the alcohol community, but we figured out that our parents had liquor cabinets, so we devised the plan. And I've heard this similar plan among other alcoholics and how kids did it. But you know, we went into their liquor cabinet on Saturday afternoon when the parents were gone somewhere else and took a little bit out of each bottle, right? So we got a little bit of gin, a little bit of vodka, a little bit of scotch, a little bit of whiskey and vermouth, and it didn't matter what it was. We had no clue what it was. All we knew was that we were trying to get just a little bit out, and we put a little water back in because I was pretty sure that my dad was watching the levels of the bottles, and so I went, you know, I was looking for marks on there. I didn't really see any, but I had an idea that he was watching it very closely. And my parents, you know, just a little bit about my family background. I hear a lot of stories about abuse and various, you know, there are all kinds of different backgrounds that we come from. My parents were not alcoholic. They didn't beat me. There was no abuse. My dad was kind of a strict German guy and an engineer, and he was always by the book, and he didn't drink very much. He's the kind of guy that sort of just measured out his drinks. And my mom, she would drink a little bit, and she'd giggle, and that was it. But all I know is I just had this feeling that I was destined somehow, that alcohol was something special that I wanted to try. So we had these quart containers, and Richard and my brother and I filled these two quart containers during the day, and we hid them. And then our plan was that we would sneak out in the middle of the night, which became a theme of ours later on. But we would sneak out, which we did with these bottles, and we went down to the golf course, and we proceeded, us three guys, two of us were 15, and my brother was 14, and we drank this ungodly, satanic concoction, you know, that nobody in their right mind would drink, but you know, it was just, oh man, it just warmed me up. It felt so good, and it didn't taste really very good, but just the whole effect. And in the big book, it says we drink for the effect. We alcoholics drink for the effect. And man, I loved the effect. I loved it more than anything else I had ever experienced. And we laughed, and we fought each other. I got in a fist fight with Richard, and we threw rocks at cars that were driving by, and we threw up, and it was just so much fun. And the next morning, we snuck back, got into our houses, and the next morning, I woke up, and I was bruised and bloody, and I was hungover, I was sick. And I just thought, I want to do that again. And I want to do it a lot. I want to do it every day. That became my, you know, some people say, you know, some kids who you might have known, say, I want to be an astronaut, you know. I want to be a physicist. And I'm thinking, man, I want that feeling again. I just want that feeling. That's all I knew. And that became my goal in life. And we lived up in Glendale, up in the L.A. area, and it was just suburbia, you know. I mean, it wasn't a bad place. It wasn't a rich place. It wasn't a poor place. It was just suburbia. And I knew that alcohol was going to be my best friend forever. Shortly thereafter, another milestone in my life was when my brother and I, he was still 14 and I was 15, we had a friend named Carl, and Carl and his dad were rebuilding a 57 Chevy, and it was a pretty nice car. And the whole deal was that when Carl got to be 16, that he was going to have this car, you know, it's going to be his car. But his dad owned it, and Carl was 14 years old. But Carl was my brother's friend, my brother and I thought, hey, why don't we get Carl to meet us in his car in the middle of the night, and we can do that sneaking thing out of the window again. And in the meantime, some other friends had introduced us to a different kind of chemical that was packaged up differently. And I know this is AA, but, you know, what I say is that drugs were a big part of my story. Alcohol is my drug of choice. That did it for me. But when I was 15 years old, it was hard for me to buy alcohol. It was easy for me to buy drugs. And I was telling my daughter, who's 23 years old, I was saying something about dope, and she said, why do you call it dope, Dad? Why? It's called weed. It's called weed. And I said, maybe it's because it's what it makes you into, a dope, you know? It makes you into a dope. It was marijuana, and which is nothing, apparently nothing like marijuana today. And I think it was just like smoking a weed. I was talking with a counselor recently because... of some issues in my family and some stuff going on with my adult kids. And I said, I don't know, the way it's affecting me, says it is totally different, the THC level. So anyway, we're going back to alcohol mostly, okay? So we convinced Carl to drive his really sweet 57 Chevy in the middle of the night and meet us at midnight. We climbed out the window. We jump in the car. We got a little bit of beer, and we've got some dope with us. And we drive down into Hollywood, and we're going, man, we're going to go to Sunset Strip, and we are going to go to drive Hollywood Boulevard, and there's hookers down there, and we're 14 and 15 years old. And we also had a flashing red light that you plug into the cigarette lighter that you can chase cars around with. How cool is that? So we're cruising around down there, and we're just suburban kids, you know, and our parents had high hopes for us, and we're driving down Sunset Strip, Hollywood Boulevard. We're yelling at the people down there. We're kids in a car. We were smart. We didn't use the flashing red light on the big boulevards. We'd go onto the side streets, and we'd pull up behind cars and plug it in and start, and then they would pull over, and we would laugh at them. We'd drive by. And in the meantime, we're drinking a little beer and we're smoking some dope and we're getting kind of high. And then we drove back up to where we live in Glendale, La Crescenta, La Cunada, Foothill Boulevard. Boom, driving down the boulevard. We were taking turns driving. And what I didn't understand was Carl was not a very good driver, okay? He's 14 years old. Apparently, he had not been reading the DMV manual. You're supposed to keep your eyes on the road while you're driving, be aware of all the vehicles around you, your surroundings. Carl, we were having trouble with the light, the flashing light, which was the problem. Carl took it. He was trying to help us while he was driving. Somehow, two parked cars popped up in front of us. Bam! We hit both, sideswiped one, hit the other one. Not a good situation. Couldn't get out of my door. I was thinking I'm going to run. My brother's in the back. I had braces on my teeth, and my face was smashed against the dashboard. That wasn't good either. And so we got out of the car. We threw some stuff down into a canyon, threw our stuff down there, and so there was no evidence. And my parents showed up. The cops called them, and I guess they said, well, your children are here with us. No, they're not. They're asleep, you know. We were not asleep. We were up on Foothill Boulevard. And so the Carl, I guess, went to the police station, and my brother and I were put in the supervision of our parents, and my dad yelled, my mom cried. That was a pretty constant theme throughout the years. My dad was yelling, my mom was crying about it. So that is kind of how it progressed over the next few years. Even though I was going to high school, I was admitted to college, I started going to university up in L.A., but I just had these two lives. I mean, I would kind of work pretty hard on the weekdays and study, but I just didn't like it. I was always dreaming and thinking about the weekend and getting loaded, and I was just, that was all I wanted to do. And so I was able to kind of get into the university life, but as soon as I was away from my parents and I went away to school, man, it was on. And it was all day, every day. And something happened. Apparently my grades suffered. And there was a situation where I met with my counselor and he said, you know, you've got a 1.8 GPA here. And I said, yeah. He said, that's below a C average. It's not very good. I said, D plus. And said, yeah, not good. And he explained to me how I needed to bring my grades up and things like that. And so I did the only thing that you do in that situation. You start thinking about ways that you can protect your chemical use. And I heard somebody say, alcoholics, instead of modifying their behavior to reach their goals, they modify their goals to maintain their behavior, right? So, and that's really, it is so true. And so the first thing I did was I said, well, I got to get out of engineering, man. It's just way too tough a major. I got to study like every night. It's physics and calculus and all this, you know, I don't want to do that anymore. Anyway, I really don't want to be an engineer. What is a really easy major? And so I said business school, and I said, but business, they got accounting, right? I said, yeah, but marketing is pretty easy because you do a paper, two papers every semester or something like that. I said, marketing, that's for me. So I switched into marketing, which is good. I'm a marketing kind of guy. And so got into marketing, and I was still proceeding with my extracurricular activities. Had an issue one evening where I visited some friends up in the La Crescenta area, and I'm going to take off my watch and let's see where I'm going here. And my car didn't turn on the road when the road turned. So I ricocheted off a telephone pole, went through a picket fence and a hedge, and ran in the front of the Russian Apostolic Church in Eagle Rock. Boom. I put it in reverse. I'm getting out of here. What I didn't realize was all my tires were no longer inflated. So a couple of them had blown. So I couldn't get off out of this. I kind of dug in. So they threw me in jail, Eagle Rock. My mom and dad came. My dad yelled. My mom cried. You know, that was that whole thing again. And I'm 18 at that point. Shortly thereafter, I was, just kind of crazy. Some friends, fraternity house. We'd been at the beach all day drinking. Walked through a glass door. Stitches. I just kind of flew through it, you know, like one of these over here. I was barefoot, sliced off a part of the side of my foot, plastic surgery in the middle of the night. That was not a good thing either. I'm still thinking it's bad luck. You know how sometimes you go through this whole thing and you say, I'm just doing what my friends are doing and I just want to have fun. And a turning point in my life. And this doesn't always work. I went home on Saturday to visit my parents. And I don't know why, 10 in the morning. I'm not sure why I was doing that. I'm usually not up that early on Saturday. But I drove home and I had a dog, my Springer Spaniel that I'd grown up with. And I was laying on the kitchen floor wrestling around with the dog. Seemed okay to me. The floor was cool, and I'd been drinking all morning. And I just thought it was a normal thing to do. And my mom comes in, and she's going through this. What do you do? I said, I just thought I'd come home and see you and Dad. Apparently my speech was slurred. And she says, you've been drinking, haven't you? And I said, I don't know, not really. I drank a little bit last night. She says, you're drunk again. She says, that's all you do is drink. You don't major in business. You major in drinking. Get out of my house. And I said, what are you talking about, Mom? And she screamed. She said, get out of my house. You're an alcoholic. Get out of my house. And that was the first time that alcoholic thought popped into my mind, the concept that I could be an alcoholic. I kind of knew that there was something different about me. No, I mean, really, I'm serious that I drank different from my other friends, even though I was partying with them. I drank in the morning, for instance, and the first time I drank in the morning, I thought, this is so cool. You know, I did it to counter a hangover. A friend of mine said, you can have a cup, you know, the hair of the dog, and it'll counter it. And when it worked for me, it made me feel really good, and it was almost like, wow, I know this. I don't think everybody knows about this. I thought it was some kind of just sort of a secret thing. Wow, most people don't know about it. I don't think it's socially acceptable, but, you know, it works for me. And I just thought I was a little bit, I don't know, I thought maybe I was psychologically impaired or something, honestly. So which I guess I was. And another buddy of mine in the program, he says, AA is not a hotbed of mental health, you know. You may have heard that saying. It's true. So, and another friend says, we are the elite of the mentally ill. I like that. So, got to be elite of something. So, I'd been in jail. I'd smashed into a church. I went to a treatment center that, and this is significant. It's not just drunk a log, but you know, when my mom yelled at me, I drove out of there and I was just feeling really depressed. And I had seen this, it was kind of in the Hollywood area, Alcohol Information Services Center or something like that. And I drove down and I just walked in the door of this place and I said, I may be an alcoholic and I want to talk with an alcoholic. And the woman at the front said, well, we have a counselor here that you can speak with. And she's really an expert and knows exactly everything about alcoholism. And I said, I want to speak with an alcoholic. And I knew that there was something different about my thought process and about what was going on with the way I drank. I said, I just want to speak with an alcoholic. So the counselor sat me down and talked with me, and then she introduced me to a guy who was alcoholic, and I was telling him, this is what I do, and this is how I feel. And I said, does that make sense to you? And then he shared with me how what he did and how he felt, and that, you know, he was going down the road of sobriety. And I thought, you know, maybe this is something I need to do. And during that whole process, I was 20 years old at the time. During that process, they explained to me about Ann abuse. They were telling me about Ann abuse because I told them, I said, I don't think I can quit drinking. I don't think I can stop. And so they prescribed Ann abuse for me in this clinic. And I took that for several months. And it helped me because I was terrified of getting violently ill, right, on this stuff, which it did make me violently ill because I finally decided to drink. You know, went on a ski trip with my buddies, and so that was not a not a pleasant experience. But it's a preventive chemical that, and that's the reason for it. You know, if you drink, you'll get sick, so don't drink. I've met a couple other people who've taken it, but it's kind of rare, I guess. I don't know. I was in the Navy, had a lot of turmoil in the Navy. You know that how they say, join the Navy and see the world. I was 4 years in the Navy after college, and I saw a whole bunch of bars. And all over the world, Philippines, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, Kenya, Australia, some other Navy people here? Yeah. And I did do a few other things, but mostly just drank. I just drank. And so from the time I was 20 years old till I was 27 years old, I'd try AA every once in a while, and then I'd go out and drink, and then I'd stop drinking for a while, and then I'd do marijuana maintenance. You know, I'm thinking, okay, I can smoke marijuana, and take other kinds of pills, but I can't drink because I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not a drug addict. You know, I mean, that just sounds so bad. I'm not a drug addict, so. You know, I was just wrestling with this whole concept. And you know, I've got my son's 21 and my daughter's 23, and they know I'm an alcoholic, and they've seen me take cakes, and they know all about this. But, you know, I'm really struggled with some of the stuff that has gone on in their lives. And you know, it's, Dad, everybody's doing it. You know, and that's the way I was when I was in my 20s. It's like, oh my God, I can't quit drinking. What's my life going to be? It'll be nothing. It'll be totally empty. I brought my buddy with me tonight, and he's kind of new in the program. Going, yeah, I don't. What am I going to do? I said, well, you're going to come to a meeting tonight with me, you know. And when you're new, It's what do I do? And for me, I found I had a really great sponsor early on, and he said, quit thinking about things you can't do. Think about the things you can do. You know, you're filling the void. Fill it with stuff, you know. Start living your life. And so I started getting out and doing a lot of ocean activities. I like sailing and surfing and doing stuff outdoors and doing a lot of hiking, going up into the mountains. And that's pretty cool for me. Anyway, that's me. I got arrested a second time in Long Beach, and the Long Beach, I guess they're the Long Beach police, I don't know who they are, they turned me over to the Shore Patrol, and I was commissioned officer, and the Shore Patrol guy, he picks me up, he's a petty officer, he goes, I've never actually arrested an officer before, I'm not too sure what to do, and I said, can you drive me to my friend's house? And he drove me all the way across town to my buddy's house where I could drink some more that night, you know. That's what I needed. I went to the Navy's treatment center a year before I got out of the Navy, and the Navy's treatment center gave me a whole, really just a good understanding of alcoholism and chemical dependency, and they, you know, my recollection is that the theory was evolving at that point, and this was in 76, I think, that alcoholism and drug addiction are really kind of the same. It's just a chemical dependency issue that is in different form. You know, you've got alcohol, but it's in a liquid form, and you've got all these you smoke something and you snort something and you do all this other stuff. So they started treating them the same. And I had I had a good period of sobriety after that. And one of the things that I remember that was a really interesting point was I was in the treatment center. It was an inpatient center that was 6 weeks, I believe, down at 32nd Street. And they bussed us around to different meetings. And one of the meetings they took us down to was South Bay Pioneers. And so we got into the meeting, and I'm sitting down, and I'm looking around the room, and I'm kind of, and they say, who's the speaker? It's going to be that lady, Maria, and she's a middle-aged Hispanic lady. I thought she was really old. She's probably 20 years younger than I am right now, and I was 25 or something, and I just thought, what a waste of time. I've got nothing in common with this woman or this meeting or anything. And so I don't know if I can do the accent, but she got up and she said, my name is Maria. She said, I had my first drink when I was 14 years old, and it went down into my stomach and it exploded like a firecracker and went up into my brain. And I sat there and I had chills, and I thought, I'm exactly like her, you know. And alcoholism, my sponsor says, it's an ism, it's not a wasm. He goes, it's no respecter of socioeconomic status, race, creed, color. It doesn't matter who you are, you know. And we all come together, and we are the same. You know, we're the same inside. I hear people tell stories that look so different from me or act different, dress different, and they're the same inside. He said it exploded like a firecracker. So how much more time do I have? 10? Okay. So what happened? You know, I mean, sometimes I get all involved in talking about, you know, the drunkalogue. What happened? So I'm relapsing for 7 years back and forth. I was living in Pacific Beach. I just got out of the Navy. I was unemployed. I was trying to sort of figure out what I was going to do with my career. I was kind of drinking, kind of not drinking, but I was going on these binges, you know. I mean, I was doing this periodic stuff at that time, and I'd have this sobriety, 90 days, 6 months, 2 days, 3 hours, you know. I mean, it was just like, and I knew I was an alcoholic, but I couldn't stop, you know. I just have these periods because I wasn't getting involved in AA. I was going to meetings, but I didn't want to hang around afterwards. I didn't want to get to know anybody. I didn't want to do any H&I. I didn't want to have any friends. I didn't want to have a sponsor. I'd just go to the meetings and I'd go, maybe I can get something out of this damn thing and you know, without having to socialize with people. It's just not what I want to do, you know. I got my own friends. Yeah, it's so great. I remember going from the Navy's treatment center on kind of a furlough thing, and my girlfriend, I'd been there, I don't know, 3 weeks or something, and so she picked me up, and we drove over to my buddy's house in Pacific Beach, and these guys knew that I was in treatment. Even they were saying they thought I had a problem, you know. So and I just, you know, I go, oh, man, you guys could say that to me. We walked in the door of this little house in Pacific Beach, and they had a keg of beer over here, and there were guys doing lines over here on a mirror, and there were people smoking weed in the backyard, dope in the backyard, and alcohol everywhere, and I wanted to be a normal guy. I wanted to fit in, but here I was in the middle of my treatment, knowing I knew and believed I was an alcoholic, but I didn't want to quit, you know? I just didn't want to quit. I just thought life is worthless without it. So it was during kind of that period where I was just going on these crazy binges, and one weekend that just was totally insane, driving by myself, some female hitchhiker, she was going down to Imperial Beach to pick up some junk from her dealer, and I thought, oh, that's a good idea. I should go along with you. I should give you a ride down there and hang out with you for the day, you know? And it was just this crazy, weird, nightmarish kind of day, and the following day the same, and the turning point in my life was that Sunday night. I'm in my apartment in Pacific Beach. Water break, thank you. And it's the magic mirror scene. And I'm in my bathroom in my apartment in Pacific Beach. And I've got Mickey's Big Mouth that I'm drinking. Does anybody know what that is? Raise your hand if you have. Little keg bottles, green, and it's got a four-leaf clover. It's an Irish malt liquor thing. And it was pretty good, but, you know, I mean, it did the job. That's what I wanted. And you pull off this funny kind of metal foil top thing, and I'm staring in the mirror, and I'm drinking, and I'm looking at me, and I'm drinking Mickey's Big Mouth, and it's not working anymore. It's not getting me loaded. Alcohol's not working for me now. And I hated what I saw. And what I saw in the mirror was what other people saw. I didn't, you know how when you're out there using and drinking and you're so cool, you look in the mirror and you go, I look pretty good, man. I look better than good. When I was staring in the mirror that night, I hated me. And I saw the drunken slob that I'd become, and I just thought, how did I get here? I was 27 years old, and I just thought, I look older. I mean, I was, you know, just like, I was just wasted really unhealthy circles, bags under my eyes, bloodshot eyes, just, you know, not eating right, not eating anything, I don't know, just drinking. And I stared and I drank and I tried to make it work, and it wasn't working anymore. And I started to cry. And I started to pray, and I'd prayed before. You know how you always pray when you're going to jail, or when, yeah, or when you think the boss is going to find out, or they know he said something. He wants to talk to me. I think he smelled it, or my parents, or whatever it was. Over the years, I had prayed before, but something happened that night where God. Either God was listening to me or I was listening to him, and it's probably the latter, that I just started, I broke down, and I'm in this apartment in PB alone, and my roommates are gone somewhere, and I just started crying, kind of collapsing on the bed and the floor, and I was done. I was just done. I told God, I said, just take away this obsession for me to drink and to use drugs. I can't live like this anymore. And I just, you know, I just wept, and I laid down, collapsed on my bed, and I guess I slept for about 7-8 hours. And I woke up the next day, and this is my sobriety date, December 1st, 78. I woke up the next day, and I just felt really good. I felt really good. And I wasn't cured, but what I physically I felt good, and in my mind and my heart and my soul, I knew that I didn't have to take drugs anymore, but I needed to get involved in AA. I knew how to do it. And I made that decision. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to get involved in AA, man. I am going to get sober. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm not going to use drugs anymore. I'm going to get me a sponsor, which, you know, I kept hearing about the sponsor thing, and I did. I immersed myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to get friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. All the stuff I do, I'm going to go places. I'm going to stay after meetings. I'm going to ask guys to go to coffee with me. You know, I'm going to say, hey, give me your phone number. I mean, that's what I started doing. I started doing H&I commitments. And my life changed. My life became good. You know, everything that's happened to me that's good in life is through Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I had fun. You know, there were fun times when I was drinking and using, but that wasn't, you know, I mean, my friends, yeah, I had friends, but, I mean, I have real friends now. I have friends that I can call for anything. My sponsor, when I say, I need to talk with you, Rob, he's Rob M., he's a great guy, and, you know, if I call him up at 11 at night, I said, I got to talk with you about some stuff. There's just some crazy things going on in my head. Or this happened at work. Or, you know, I've had some, you know, family issues going on the last couple of years that just shouldn't, in my mind, because the way I understood God and what was going on, if I lived this life of sobriety, I wasn't going to have bad things happen to me anymore, right? Life is going to be totally perfect. And somehow, even though I had, you know, even though with guys that I sponsor and work with, I go, look, you know, you play the cards that are dealt you and all that kind of stuff is easy to say until some big stuff goes down. And so there have been some big happenings in my life, and I'm not going to really, you know, go into all that tonight. The good news is this. The good news is that I haven't had a drink in 32 years. I'm not a circuit speaker, and I'm not a famous person in AA or anything. I'm just a person whose life revolved around alcohol and drugs, and now I can live a good life without that, you know. I have the ability, I was sharing with Sam today, I said, it's like baseball, you know. When you're drunk, they're not going to put you in the game. If you're sober, yeah, I know that you know, you go in and maybe you strike out, but there's a chance you can get a hit, you know. Even in baseball, the guys that go up, that are up to bat three times, they get one hit out of three. They're good hitters, you know. And yeah, that's what life is all about. We are just out there. We've got an opportunity to live it now. I mean, I can do anything I want to do. Had a lot of joy in my life. I've had some extreme pain in sobriety as well, and I have not had a drink through it. Married. Two kids who are adults now, dealing with that emotional sobriety. Got a couple minutes left, or am I done? Am I done? I was at. I took my wife and I took our kids on a ski trip to Big Bear, and they were 4 and 6 years old, I think. And you know, you have these expectations. You know how they talk about that? So this is about emotional sobriety. So I was about almost 20 years sober. And I'm, you know, thinking I can handle things pretty well in life. So I got these expectations, and we're going up the mountain. We're staying there for the weekend. This is going to be all exciting. Christine, our daughter, has this cool little pink, you know, ski suit, and this was pre-snowboarding, and so they got little skis, and my son Chaz, he's got his little ski outfit, and everything's cool. There's a lot going on when you're coordinating skiing for four people, because you got eight skis and eight poles and the bags for the kids and your food. You're trying to pack food and beverages and you know, we had some walkie-talkie things and it was like, you know, a lot of stuff, right? So it's a little bit complicated and the kids are saying, when are we going to get there? You know, they're starting to do some of that. And so it got worse and worse. I mean, you know, more and more. And I'm just thinking, you know, doing the Serenity Prayer. God is good. And we get up to the mountain, and we got inside the lodge, and we're getting them ready. Got to go to the bathroom before we go up on the slope, all this stuff. And Christine's going, oh! She's dragging her stuff on the ground. And my son sees video games. He goes, I want to play video games. I don't want to ski. And I said, Chaz, you are going to love skiing. You are going to love it. It's fantastic. Skiing is great. It's cold. I don't want to. I just want to do video games. And so I said, no, it's going to be fantastic. So we're there, and we're trying to get the skis on him. And then the poles are kind of sliding down this little slope, and everything things just started piling up and piling up. I had this weird out-of-body experience where Christine was complaining, and my wife was helping with some stuff, but it was totally out of control. And my son said, I just want to play video games. And I said, fine, you play video games. Forget about the skiing. And I'm screaming at the top of my lungs, but I'm right there at the bottom of the slope where the lodge is, and there's about 100 people out there, you know, and I'm right below that, and there's 100 people, they're drinking beer, and they're having fun, and we're right where the lift is going up, and we're right where people are coming down. I said, I've had it! You don't ski then! Forget it! And I reached down, and I grabbed his little skis, and like javelins, I just went, and I threw it, and it went off of this little slope thing we're in, and hit the asphalt, and went, And I grabbed the other one, and I threw that one just like it. And that one went skidding down there. And I turned around, and my kids and my wife and 200 other people were just going, who is this maniac, you know? And I'm enraged. And my wife just says, why don't you go up the slope, and I will take care of the children. I said, that's a good idea. So I go up, and on the way up, I'm thinking, God, what happened there? That was insane. And I realized that it was inappropriate behavior, as we tell the children. And so I started thinking about the 10th step, you know, and continued to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I thought, God, I need to go down and apologize. I am just, I was out of control, and I don't even know why, you know. So I did, skied down the slope, made huge amends to everybody, and more than just once, you know, throughout the day. And oh, God, I'm sorry, I don't know what happened. I went crazy. But I guess the point is, you know, I hadn't had a drink for 20 years, but like my sponsor said, it's alcoholism, it's not alcoholism. So I've still got this same stuff in my head. I'm not drinking anymore, but sometimes I go a little bit crazy. I haven't done anything like that ever again, but it was just kind of berserk. And I think there's a book that's called There's More to Sobriety Than Not Drinking or something like that. Does that sound familiar? Larry would know. He knows all these things. Yeah, okay. More to quitting drinking than quitting drinking. So I'm going to wrap it up. I really appreciate the opportunity to, share with you guys tonight. I prayed before the meeting. I said, you know, I've had all this weird stuff that's happened in my life. I pray that there's something that I would say that somebody would relate to, newcomer, old timer, somebody that where you can get something out of what I shared. And so that was my prayer tonight. My sponsor, Rob, says, you know, sometimes I talk about life might get hard or might get dull or, you know, boring or whatever. And he says the challenge, the real challenge in life is enjoying the majesty of the moment, you know. Sometimes we think so much about the past and the future, and it kind of squeezes out the moment. And you know, I appreciate the opportunity to share with you tonight. This is part of my service. I've been involved in a number of things, including H&I you know, just a variety of things with groups, secretary as well. I haven't done a huge amount of speaking, but it's been an honor to be with you. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to do that. Thanks.